outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Chain.
Hey, before we roll the podcast, let me just make an announcement. Decided to hold a God Journey after show this Sunday, 10 o'clock a.m. Pacific Daylight Time. So make the calculation for wherever you are in the world. From 10 to 11 this Sunday, June 7th. And this is going to be an open topic. Not necessarily about what we're talking about today, though we can. It's just anything you want to talk about. I'm going to let the first 30 people who say, hey, let me in, I'm going to let them in the room. And the rest of you, we're going to stream it on the God Journey Facebook page. So if you want to watch it, you're welcome to do it. That'll be 10 a.m. this Sunday morning, Pacific Daylight Time, onto the podcast. Good morning. This is take four of the God Journey because I can't get my head together. Suddenly, I'm doing an extra podcast this week I hadn't planned on doing because I got a neat phone call from my friend Arnita. She suggested that Bob and I get together with her, and we talk about an email she got that disturbed her. Bob and Arnita are my co-authors of A Language of Healing for a Polarized Nation, which seems to be more than appropriate for the weeks we're going through these days. And the tension in Minneapolis, the killing in Georgia, and the dog park story that I've blogged about, talked about in the last podcast. So happy to have you guys back and kind of sort this out as best we can. So welcome, Arnita.
Thank you. Thank you for having me and always responding to my need to discuss things.
And you had to go out and hide in the parking lot to get the signal we needed to record
this.
So
I did. I'm
sorry about that.
I'm going to talk about this today. Do you hear me?
We're fully on that. We tried in the home and got the banjo playing extra, whatever. So you moved out. Hope it's not too hot there in Texas and your car's not going to be 145 degrees time we end.
No, it won't be.
Okay. I've also got Bob Prater here from Bakersfield. Bob, welcome.
Hey, thank you, Wayne. Thanks for having me. Hello, Arnita.
Hi, Bob. How are you?
I am rocking, you know.
Cool.
Hey, before we get to the question, man, how are things going with the book? We seem to have lost a bit of momentum with the pandemic, taking out some of what we hoped to get in some colleges and universities and doing some of this with students. But we've begun Language of Healing Live, a couple of video casts that have really been kind of interesting. We'll have one coming up. I can't announce it here because this is airing after our next one. So, but if you want to go to the Language of Healing page, you can look at the past video casts that we've done with Language of Healing Live, getting people in a room, a moderator, and talking through some stuff. So how's the book feeling to you, Bob? How's it? Are you having some conversations about it?
I am having a ton of conversations, and like both of you, I field a lot of emails and Facebook messages and even texts and phone calls from folks who are wanting to know more and wanting to dive in a little deeper. You know, we all got some books that we personally bought at the beginning of this journey. And just recently I stuck them, you know, like a month ago online, a couple of them for sale. And just this week, they are popping. They are just starting to go. So I think that people are hungry for the message because the message is dead in the pocket of where we are today.
It is.
It really is.
Arnita, how about you?
Yeah, I agree. I am actually getting more phone calls, texts, and messages than I can possibly respond to. So, and, you know, I noticed on Facebook and in some social media platforms, I'm getting a lot more people endorse it. It's not that they haven't been there, but they're endorsing it again as a reasonable tool to help people bring into a conversation with people who are different, which is exactly what we wanted to do. I cannot wait for us to get into the colleges and universities, because I think being able to share some of this with upcoming leaders and a next generation is so very pivotal. So, but it's going great.
I just had breakfast with a local pastor, a leader in our city here in Bakersfield, and the reality of this has been hitting me for the last few weeks because it's like a tinderbox out in the world right now. It feels like the world is literally on fire. We've got the pandemic, we've got racial injustice, we've got all of these things happening simultaneously as the world just continues to spin. That book, Some of the things that I am privileged to be able to speak into society and into people's lives and whatnot, I hope for an immediate reaction. I hope that things change immediately. But I also have an awareness that, you know, 50 years from now, people who have read this book might put some things into practice. And so, and have heard, you know, the message of a language of healing. So I'm looking at my children. I'm looking at my grandchildren. I'm looking down the road saying, are we literally being a catalyst for something that could be big even after we're gone?
Oh, let's certainly hope so.
Yeah, I had a friend post the thing about language of healing yesterday. He's from France. He posted it in Europe saying the nation in this refers to France or the UK or Germany because we have the same problems going on in the US. I thought that was great. Not that they have the same problems, but that we can learn to talk about them a little bit. I'm with you guys, man. I made the mistake of writing a post on some of the racial stuff that's going on this weekend. Man, my box, Facebook feeds, emails, everything's just lit up. And, you know, and for the first time, I'm finding, I think, more people who look like me willing to crawl into this conversation. I think for a long time, people I know have been kind of reluctant. We don't want to deal with it. We don't want to face it. We're hoping it goes away. It's, you know, I even had one guy on the feed just say, it's, you know, it's particularly the incident in Minnesota. It has nothing to do with race. I'm going, seriously? How can you even say that? I mean, the presumption is not, it's not race. The presumption is it is about race. When a white cop takes down a black guy by crushing his neck into the pavement, how is that not about race? Does he do that to white people every few days? I mean, what's going on here? But I do find for the most part, the reaction has been, we really need to face this. We really have got to talk about it. And that was before the rioting started in Minneapolis. And that kind of makes my heart weep. Those who want to push for change in America have the high ground until they take to the streets and start firebombing stuff. And what I loved about the incident in Central Park was the guy, the African-American man that was being challenged by this white woman. He had the high ground and he stayed on it. And because he stayed on it, something really wonderful gets to happen. Not necessarily for her. I realize that's the worst day of her life. But other people are now looking at how we manipulate power racially. And that's a great thing to consider because it happens all the time, not just when a guy gets murdered on a street in Minneapolis. It's happening when, like Arnita has shared about, when you walk into a store, you're treated differently sometimes than I would be treated walking in that same store. That's the stuff that we have to talk about. And I'm glad we're getting a chance to.
It's interesting because I was struck that many of our leaders today, and I'm speaking mostly political, but some religious and in other ways, there's this phrase that I like to use called speaking truth to power. And that's, I think, what our book does a little bit. We're speaking truth to power, but there are leaders who are literally trying to speak power to truth. They're trying to overtake the truth with their power. And I'm watching in amazement in real time as leaders are trying to exert their power over truth. And that scares me a little bit. I don't know how you guys feel about it. I find it really, I mean, it's disheartening to me.
Well, the best leaders, the great leaders, define reality. That's what great leaders do. And so I agree with you, man. We could do probably a whole nother podcast on the leadership faux pas of all of what we're dealing with. But certainly leaders set the tone. I hope a lot of leaders will listen to this because leaders set the tone.
And what doesn't surprise me is I think we've seen a crash in leadership over the last 30, 40 years. I don't think we have leaders that speak truth anymore, that invite Absolutely. And inspire Americans to something better or even in the world. I think we have leaders who are only about power and they'll manipulate their versions of truth with air quotes around it to get whatever result they want. And that's Democrats, Republicans, that's across the board. I don't know that we have a statesman or stateswoman now in America that I would go, man, I'm really for that person. I love that they're willing to say what's true, even if it costs them votes or costs them influence or costs them whatever. We just don't have that leader. So I don't think that's particularly new. I do think like with this book, I would love it if the president of the United States would read Language of Healing and going, I've got to change my whole life. I do, but I have no hope that that's going to happen. I think it's got to happen, as we keep saying, one person, one conversation at a time. Let's talk about us and our lives and the people we relate to, and let's stand up against injustice when we see it. But Arnita, you got an email that disturbed you. You wanted to talk about it earlier this week, and then we said, you know, this would be a great conversation to invite the rest of the God Journey community in on. So tell us about that email or text that you got that gave you some concern.
Sure. Sure, I'd love to. It was very interesting. I actually got connected to a young lady from a mutual friend who was just really distraught. And some of her message went like this, and I quote, "I am no longer a Christian. A huge reason is the lack of support from Christians when it comes to racism. I want to understand why Christians do not condemn or speak out against racism like they do about other issues." And one of the things that bothered me so much is, as a pastor, it bothered me that she said, "I'm no longer a Christian." That just blew me out of the water. So that's when I called you, Wayne, and I was like, you know, I wonder, does she really mean that? I haven't had my personal conversation with her yet, because I wanted to unpack this with you guys first. So that's the issue that bothered me so much. It bothered my heart. It pained me for the local church that I love. And so I wanted to talk about it.
Yeah, when we first started talking, you kind of had the feeling that she had left the faith.
Yes.
That by her saying, "I'm no longer a Christian." And my feedback to that is, I know lots of passionate followers of Jesus who are completely turned off to the term Christian, because it doesn't mean anymore what it meant in the book of Acts. In the book of Acts, the Christians didn't say, "Hey, call us Christians." They were being called that by the world. They're little Christ. It's like you call somebody a Bushy if they're too pro George Bush or Jeb Bush or whoever. It's just a diminutive term to say you're too much like that other person. And Christians didn't take that title to himself. It was given to him. That you guys acting like little Christs. Now it's become, you're a practitioner of a religion called Christianity. And worse, I think in the last 40 years, I think since Moral Majority days, Christian is a certain voting bloc, usually conservative, usually white, and doesn't have concern for those kinds of issues. And they're arrogant, condescending, and it's turned off people in the world. So when I'm asked, when I fly on airplanes and I'm asked if I'm a Christian in a conversation, I'll always say, it depends on what you mean. If you mean, am I a good practitioner of a religion called Christianity? I'm not. And people swear to that on the internet. But if you're asking, am I a Christ follower? Do I want to follow Jesus? Do I want to be like him in the world? That's the kind of Christian I want to be. So that's how I respond to the term. If you're right, and this woman's leaving the faith because of this example, man, that just breaks my heart too.
Yeah, it's overwhelming. I'm kind of like you. I'm kind of the Acts girl in Acts 11 and 25 and 26, when it says that, and they were called Christians first at Antioch. I'm just kind of like, Christianity to me has nothing to do with a political affiliation whatsoever. And so just that awareness that now evangelical Christianity is different. But that's not how I read it. And again, I don't have clarity from the young lady. But Bob, what do you think?
Well, I think that for me personally, the word evangelical is a word that I kind of clawed my way out of a dozen years ago or so, where I said I can no longer, because the term evangelical has such a political connotation, as Wayne mentioned with Moral Majority, going back to the 70s and maybe even the late 60s, when the church began to realize that they could be quite a voting bloc. And by the church, I mean the evangelicals. So for me, that was the first step for me, but it kind of opened Pandora's box a bit for me. And so when she says racism, that's one, and it's a big one. I sit with a lot of gay people who have walked away. They no longer call themselves a Christian, because how can they identify with a group of people that are going to pronounce judgment on them and are going to say that there's no hope for them, and on and on and on. So, I mean, I still call myself a Christian. I do, sort of. But, like Wayne said, Christ follower. I like to call myself a believer. I'm a true believer in Jesus, and I think if Jesus is the litmus test, that's where I want to be. I want to do what he did. I want to walk the way that he walked. I want to see the world through the eyes that he saw it through, and I want to walk with compassion. And oftentimes, those who call themselves Christian are just the opposite. I mean, the group of people who is least likely to believe that racism is really an issue is the white evangelical church. And that's for real. I mean, that's studies have shown. And it's almost like a double-edged sword because they really do believe in love. And so they're looking at themselves and saying, well, I'm not racist. And so how can there be racism? I'm not racist. And our church isn't racist. And it's because they think there's an inherent goodness that comes from being identified as a Christian. I think that's part of the problem.
And I do think that's kind of probably what she's addressing. She is an African-American woman. And I do think she's talking about a PWC, a predominantly white church, where I know
PWC. I've never heard that term before.
Me neither. I'm writing it down.
PWC.
A predominantly white church.
That sounds like insider language, man. I've never heard that before.
Oh, man. Okay. Well, I let the secret out.
Yeah,
yeah.
This
is inside baseball right here.
I like the term.
But what I think is, I know hundreds of people in the North Texas area who have done the same thing. They've walked out of churches that were predominantly white churches who do not say anything when racial things happen. It's even worse when they say something to promote the police officers versus not saying something about the victim's family. So I do not think what she's talking about is a new thing. I think there's a lot of brown and black people going out of the back door of churches because of racism. But I think it's because there's not a safe place. You know, our whole book is about creating safe spaces for people to have conversations. Often, in my experience, church was the least safe place to talk about race. So I think this is a valid conversation that can help a lot of people navigate differently. But I just want to have it.
Yeah, I think it's important, too. As we've talked about, and you sent me this thing, I'm trying to think, has there ever been a church that I was a part of that I heard a sermon about or even could remember racism being mentioned? And I can't think of it. In the history of growing up in Central California, in being at ORU, I don't recall racism being condemned from a pulpit ever. And I kind of say, why would that be true? Because I wouldn't think they are intentionally supportive of racism. I just think racism got defined for some of us as what the Ku Klux Klan does. And that's racism. And yeah, well, of course we condemn it, but we don't deal with it every day because we won't have any of those people here in our fellowship. So to condemn it would be like to condemn somebody that's, you know, the pornographers who aren't there. When we talk about using pornography in a lot of white evangelical churches, but we don't talk a lot about the pornographers because we don't expect them to be there. So I wonder if that's not part of it. And I think racism for the community I come from became such a big word that only really, really bad people do it. And what I love about the video of that woman in Central Park, I don't think she would think of herself as a racist. I don't think at all. I just think in a moment of extremity, she chose a racial aspect to try to gain power in a circumstance where she had lost it. If we're going to have effective conversations about racism, we've got to be able to see it in our own lives and in our own history. And we make it something so stark as to be only really, really bad people do racism and don't see the more subtle ways, just the way we evaluate somebody walking past us on a street because of the color of their skin or feel less secure in a certain situation. Or you talk about going into stores and being watched more closely so you're not going to shoplift, where I've never had that happen to me ever, as far as I know.
Well, you know, in the book, I tell a story of going into a church in North Texas and being greeted by the welcome team with the question, oh, you must be in the wrong place. Well, you know, that's covert, but it's overt. But what did that say to me as a black person going into a predominantly white church? It tells me, A, it's not a lot of me in here. B, in your mind, I'm not even supposed to be here because you are assuming, you are trying to redirect me. I totally get what the young lady is saying.
I hear it.
But I think as long as in churches where people mix, you still have you still see me as an out-group, you are still operating in a racist mentality. I can't walk into your church and you see me as an out-group. Now, my hair alone, my afro is big.
I've seen it. I'll vouch for that.
So you can stare at me because I have big hair, but you shouldn't be staring at me because I'm in a church with brown skin.
Right.
That says a lot more to me. And I don't think church is a safe place to talk about racism and difference. You often get labeled as being divisive, Jezebel-like talk. It's not a comfortable place to talk about it. And I do think that directly relates to leadership capacity to create those environments. I do. I believe we have to have these talks.
Oh, I do too. I think even the illustration you just gave, I think most people I grew up with would say, oh, that was just an innocent mistake. That's how they would see it. They wouldn't see it as racism. And that's why we have a hard time conversing about this.
Right.
Because then it kicks in the whole, oh, guilt thing. If we're racist and don't know it, then that's ugly. So we don't want to go there. So even I can't believe how many people, even on my Facebook feed, will try to bend so far backward to say, well, you can't always put race behind these things like the incident in Minneapolis. Well, why can't you? I mean, but that's, it seems like, I know there's a book out there about white fragility or something, just the inability of Caucasian people to say, you know what, I can look back at my past and see, yeah, I have made some of these things. And no, they're not just innocent mistakes. They come from indoctrination. They come from stuff I've been taught and grown up around, and it's all okay among us, but it's not okay right. In the wider world. And I think that's what we've missed. And I hope we have these conversations too, because I think it needs to be called not just racism is sin. I mean, we got to say that. That's obviously true. But we've also got to look for how does that work its way into my heart and actions and mentality toward other people. Just because I don't care about this issue as much as my friends of color who experience these kinds of things all the time. They care about it. It doesn't affect me, so I don't have to care about it. I've got friends that are that way. And I know for me, the last 5 years, there's been some changes in my life going on, even my association with you, Arnita. I talk about this very differently than I did 2 years ago. And I'm much more open about it because I see the importance of people like me talking about this. And I got friends who've said, wait, you've never talked about this before. Why are you suddenly focused on race all the time? And I'm going, well, it's not all the time. It's not most of my life even. But I have people I care about who face this. And now I can't just sit back and let it go by.
Yeah, I've had the same responses from several of my friends. And most of them are along the lines of, you know, who do you think you are? And I think as a culture, especially white culture, it's something that I kind of jokingly called the Homer Simpson syndrome. There was a Simpsons cartoon 25, 30 years ago. Homer is sitting there stuffing his face with donuts and watching Itchy and Scratchy on TV, which is a cartoon. You've all probably seen it. It's a cat and a mouse, and they like use chainsaws on each other. I mean, it's bloody and violent, and he is laughing hysterically as they are mutilating each other, cutting off arms and stuff like that. And he goes, it's funny because it's not happening to me. And I just went, oh my gosh, how profound is that? Because it's not happening to me. I don't have to care. These things don't happen predominantly in white culture, the same things that happen to black culture. And so many of us just, we don't have the level of empathy because it's not happening to us. And so this heavy dose of empathy is everything. The ability to put on lenses and see through someone who's different. And then proximity. You're right, Wayne. The friendship with Arnita is one that shifts mindsets just because we're friends. I don't know what all the answers are, but we are locked, honestly, in that Homer Simpson reality.
And not just because we're friends. It's because Arnita lets us into a world. We have discussions about race that even Arnita, you said you've rarely had with white males. Okay, so it's that conversation that's been so powerful. So I want to ask you, Arnita, what is it that you and your friends would want the white church, and I hate even saying that because I hate that there's a white church and a black church, but there is. But the predominant, let's go with the PWC. What would you want to see happen among believers in those groups?
I think divinely God has positioned me and called me to kind of be in the middle, to be a voice in between, you know, predominantly white church and black church. I've done both. I love both. I love the body of Christ. You know, if I knew Spanish as a language, I'd probably go into one, into a Hispanic church as well. I just, you know, I have a language barrier.
I love that.
But I think the thing that the young lady is referring to, and you kind of touched on it when you said, you know, I've never heard a sermon on it. Who is discipling the body of Christ in anti-racism? Racism is in the Bible. Racism is sin. So it gives the church a perfect platform to address it. Why don't we? You know, is racism in the cellular level of the church so much that we can't address it? I think those are the questions that I have sometimes. And I often know the answers to that. Another reason I think it doesn't get addressed is people don't know what to say. You know, Wayne and Bob, we've talked, sometimes words are just landmines. You don't know when you're going to hit one. You just don't know. Yep. But my thing is, you have to say something. You have to say something. Because when I'm a black parishioner and my spiritual leader is a white man, I am listening for you to bring some type of lightning to the heaviness that I experience that you don't experience. You don't have to say a lot. But I don't think you can just totally ignore it and be a leader that should be stewarding hearts that have different skin colors. And that's our need to in leadership. I think there's a lot of fear around it, a lot of shame around it. And Wayne, as you said, I think it doesn't get addressed because people don't understand the subtle expressions, the microaggressions, the aversive racism that we talk about in our book, in the chapter Friendly Fire. I think it's a lot of things.
One thing I would say, I think a lot of pastors know that if I jump on this third rail on a Sunday morning, I may have 80% of my people really love it and like it. But the 20% that just, you ruined my Sunday morning. I don't come here to talk about the world. I come here to have Jesus exalted in my heart. And the people that take the high ground, air quotes around the high ground, this is all about Jesus. This is not about cultural kinds of division. Because when I post on Facebook, Bob, when you post on Facebook, there are people that get really ticked off if you're talking about racism. They just get really ticked. We've already dealt with that. We dealt with it 150 years ago. It does not happen in our society anymore. That's the bubble they want to live in. And when you poke that bubble, they get really angry. The post I did on that man that was shot by the white guys in the pickup in Georgia, I had a guy just say, you know, they're all thugs. He puts that on my Facebook page. I know this guy. I've been in his home. And I'm like, really, how can you talk that way? Seriously. But that's what they're afraid of, starting a big church fight. Thing blows up. Half the 20% of the people move down, start their own church. Now the finances are. I know pastors deal with that every day. I don't deal with losing an audience. But I think pastors do. They worry about it.
Oh, listen to me. There's this, the elephant in the room, again, is there are people who have equated a flag with a cross. And it's, you know, and I don't know what order it comes in, but the flag is equal. And when we, and I don't want to be anti anything, but when we have a leader who, when militiamen march on Michigan with rifles, automatic rifles, and he says, these are good people. These are good people. And he encourages the governor of Michigan to sit down and quote unquote, make a deal. And last night tweets that these are thugs in the street protesting and literally says, when the looting starts, the shooting starts. Then I think that those who are truly nationalistic in their view of Christianity are not going to say anything against that, because they know that there's a certain element of their congregation that is going to disconnect from them if they challenge that. But this is the very thing that has to be challenged. It has to be spoke. We have to speak up. It's imperative, or else we have no hope.
So what do we say to this young lady? What do we say to her? Do I just look at her and say, you know what? You're going to have to understand the people in the church aren't God. I can say that. You don't have to lose your Christianity label because people don't want to address the pain in your life. What are some practical things that I say to her? What do you say to her?
I would just get in a conversation and find out what exactly she means. Are you really leaving your faith over this, or are you just now uncomfortable with the term politically? I would find that out. If it's I'm really leaving my faith over this, I mean, I spend my whole life trying to get people to disconnect the failures of the church from the reality of God. Because I have some, for very different reasons than this, but I have people just, you know, when they give up on the church, they give up on God, because the church is the physical representation of God. Well, not man's institutional church. Sometimes it is, a lot of times it's not. So you got to divide between the failures of man and who God is. And I would tell her, man, if you're in a PWC and that's not happening, and I don't know how much courage she has, I don't know if she's an introvert, extrovert, but you got to be a voice for change. When people speak up, change happens. And change may be you have to leave, lady. They may kick you out. But then you need to find a better church. You need to find a church that sustains what you know to be true about God, and not be part of a club that's got biases it won't deal with, and it will ignore scriptures to protect itself. You just can't stay in that kind of environment. I would have that conversation just to see where she's at.
That's beautiful. Yeah, I think that's good. The other day, when the George Floyd stuff happened, I posted on Facebook, hey, send me a message or post here if your pastor talks about or made a statement about this type of injustice, a video of literal murder being videoed. And several people responded. And to wrap up that post, I basically said, you know, you need to understand kind of what you're saying. Are the values, the priorities of the church that you affiliate with, do they even think it's a priority to say anything? Some don't. Some do. Go affiliate with one who does. But it is hurtful when you have leaders who will not even let you speak to the level of suffering that you have because they do not understand it. I think part of being a good pastor is understanding everyone goes through trauma and suffering, and you need to be able to speak to it no matter how it shows up in a life. I do think that's a leadership constraint sometimes, but it really does challenge you to have the unconditional love and heart of God.
Amen. I think that's really good.
Listen, Arnita, it's I've been on this quest for several years now where I've sat with people and said, I'm now looking for my people. I think everybody needs to find their people that they can consider, that they can just let their hair down with, and they can be who they are. Because I realized that I was moving in a direction that much of the white evangelical church wasn't moving. But at the same time, I'm the whitest man on the face of the planet. I mean, for real, there is nobody whiter than me, according to my DNA test. But I find myself shifting both theologically culturally to where I'm just looking and I'm saying, you've got all these people that are completely in your camp who you can just be yourself with. And I'm the guy who just looks at the world through a different lens, but I still believe in a miraculous God. I still believe in the supernatural power of prayer. I still believe in all of these things. And I have had a difficult time finding my people, but I think that it's imperative. And this kind of goes along with one of the chapters in our book about tribalism, that tribalism can have positive effects. It's not always negative. And if the tribe that you've been associating with has become toxic, you need to get on your horse and find a new tribe that understands you and that will accept you exactly where you are. And that has been a literal quest of mine for the last 5 years.
I think that's true. I mean, I appreciate your thoughts there. I'm kind of thinking through it. You know, as an African American person who chose to go to predominantly white churches I found that if I could assimilate more to whiteness, you know, I could survive there. But if there are very few places, I should be able to be black and Christian no matter where I go. Now, I can do that real easy in a black church. So I really do understand what this lady is saying.
I do too.
But when I go over to a white church, it's kind of like, well, you know, you probably need to be a little bit more like us, which is so hypocritical if you understand the divine diversity that God created the universe and we're all made in his image. So it kind of sounds like people are double-minded when you really can't receive people in church. There is a spiritual side of the body of Christ, and there is a social side to it. And I think a lot of leaders struggle with the tension of both of those existing simultaneously.
Right.
I think they do. And I think what we said earlier about leadership at the country level, I think it's also been true in smaller institutions around the country for a long time, that mostly it's about keeping the job, saying what I need to say to make things work, and not really being able to be prophetic in the sense of being able to call out things when they need to be called out and help people explore.
Yes.
And I just see it on my own feeds. I see the racism question immediately polarizes, and nobody wants to do that to their group. So they pretty much stay to the safe ground and don't get into it. When I hope what we can do, I know for me, knowing you, Arnita, and hearing your stories and others that I've related to closer, Courtney on a podcast recently, other people of different cultural backgrounds than me, and hearing their stories that I've never heard. I don't know why I've never heard these stories. I mean, you read them in books, but it just seemed like that would never happen where I live. But I've actually begun, as I'm navigating the culture I'm in, less so during the pandemic, but I'm going through airports. When I watch how people are treated, I'm a very aware of race. I'm very aware. I've got a friend here who's doing an outreach to gang youth in the area. I know when I walk into a meeting with him, he's treated differently than I'm not there. He's a Hispanic male. And I just go, you know, I'm aware that these people have faced it every day of their life. They face that kind of racial injustice. So when something happens like Minneapolis, that's not the problem. That is just another, the hugest expression of a problem we live with every day. And I think we've got to, well, I'd love to see a sermon on that. Why don't we go racism exploring this week? Not as, you know, we're hunting for the Ku Klux Klan. Just look for ways that you see people treated differently because of their skin color. Just look for ways that happens around you. And when you open your eyes to it, it's kind of like stuff, oh, you never see it because you never think about it. You're not looking for it. When you start looking for it, you can't help but see it. And then the question becomes, what do I do about it? Do I say something? Do I find ways? And I'm finding ways into the culture I live in. I'm not going to let something like that go by me anymore. I'm just not. One, I let it go by me because I wasn't seeing it. Now I see it. And now that calls a different response out of me. But I'm one of those persons. I don't mind creating a bit of a confrontation. I don't mind. It's never bothered me.
And I think it's important to find people, again, that everybody wants to be known. Something that we all have in common as human beings. But beyond being known, being with people who celebrate you rather than tolerate you is absolutely key. I heard a story this morning there's a guy named Chris Vallotton, who is a pastor out of Redding, California. And he was on a Zoom call with several African-American folks from their church. And he said, as he began to just ask the questions, how are you feeling? People began to weep. And he said, before long, every single person in the Zoom session was weeping. And he said, something amazing happened. He said, just like Jesus became a man and became a human and came into our story, he said, I found that we were not weeping with them. We had the ability to weep as them. And he said, it was a shifting moment for them. And I thought that was pretty profound. I mean, it seems profound to me. And I think that's the key, where we can feel and where we can celebrate, because everybody wants to be celebrated.
Good.
It's more than just sermons. I wish this gal, if before she leaves the church she's in, maybe she can't talk to the leadership. Maybe she can. I think it'd be great. But I'd even start sharing with some people around her. Here's how I feel attending here. And I think people, when they hear that, it gives them a chance to either lean into that space and care about another human being, or fly their true colors and say, yeah, just not an issue here. We don't care about that.
Yeah, that's so true. You know, it's funny because normally people who have the courage to speak up about this kind of stuff, who are really catalysts normally get annihilated. You know, they just kind of get shot down like, yeah, we don't want to hear that. Get that out of here. We don't have that problem here. When you are honestly trying to get clarity and understanding, but when leaders don't want to deal with it, you kind of get removed. But at least you get to understand which side of the camp you're on and make your own decisions. There are so many churches that are justice and socially justice driven that are going to speak out about stuff like this. Go online with one of those, but try and talk to them. Yeah.
Just try. Yeah, it just, if you say, it doesn't have to be confrontive. It doesn't have to be nasty. All you can just say is, you know what I feel like when this happens in my world, this incident in Minneapolis, and it breaks my heart, and I come here and nothing is said about it here. How am I supposed to feel about that? And you ask that of people, it's non-confrontational, and it gives you a chance to get a read. Is there anybody here that cares? Or is it just too much of a third rail that we can't jump on it? But hopefully this young lady is not leaving her faith. I know we're out of time. We're kind of running to the end of it here. Arnita, did we help you process this email?
You guys helped me process the email. Actually, I heard from the young lady this morning, and I told her we were doing this podcast.
Oh, wow. Cool.
So I'm probably just going to, when this airs, I'm probably going to just direct her to
That's
it.
Great.
But, you know, Galatians 3:28, Jew nor Gentile, slave nor free, male nor female, we're one in Christ Jesus. That is always a good place to stay. It's harder for us to practice. And I want the local church and the body at large to be places that can be practiced.
Me too.
I love this conversation, and I think I'm a proponent of speaking up for those who are being oppressed, for those who can't speak for themselves, and so I think this is, you know, I think we're taking steps forward, and I appreciate that. I appreciate you, Arnita, too, the openness and the willingness to have hard discussions.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. Same with you guys. You know, it's just been nothing short of life changing for me in so many different aspects. The other day I posted in our group, you know, what's the gift that you get when you learn from people who are different? And man, the answers were great, but I was thinking, man, you get the gift of understanding coming from so many different levels. It will be overwhelming in a good way.
And it is risky. I mean, we've all taken risks in this journey together, but they've all paid off delightfully well. So tell people to take the risk. There's a whole chapter on being a disruptor, which is willing to ask the tough question, willing to poke at the thing. So if you haven't read the book yet, take a look at that as well. Hey, thanks, Bob, Arnita, for joining me today. We could talk about this like we did the other thing, went for 2 hours, but we're not going to do it.
So. Thank you, Wayne.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.